Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. What a pleasure to welcome you this evening to Somerville College, founded in 1879 with the mission of including the excluded, who, of course, at the time were women. We're delighted to have been a mixed college since 1994, but we are also fiercely proud of our history and our heritage. And there could be no better place, I think, to mark 40 years since the country elected its first woman Prime Minister, and 100 years since women were first allowed to enter the professions. In the last 140 years, the college has nurtured thousands of women who, until relatively recently, were most certainly living in a man's world, and I would suggest that perhaps too many still do. Notwithstanding the countless cultural and legislative barriers, our alumni were catalysts for change in our communities, in our country, and in our world. Some of them were invisible to the wider world, whilst being extraordinarily successful and responsible for huge advances in science, in public policy, in public service, in business, in academia, in medicine, in literature, and in the arts. Somerville's women are a testament to the difference that women have made. They are making, and they will continue to make in this world. They've blazed a trail and inspired other women to see themselves as philosophers, like the illustrious trio of Mary Midgley, Philippa Foote, and Elizabeth Anscombe, as diplomats, like Anne Warburton, the first woman to be a British ambassador, or Booker Prize-winning authors, like Iris Murdoch and A.S. Byatt. They have shown other women that it is possible to enter politics and bring about change, from Eleanor Rathbone to Shirley Williams to our current parliamentarians. In fact, yesterday I led a debate in the House of Lords on the mental health of children and young people, and who should answer it? A Somervillian, Baroness Blackwood of North Oxford. Somerville's women have lifted barriers for other women. Cornelia Sarabji, in 1889, was the first female to study law at Oxford, having been the first woman to graduate from Bombay University. And she went back then to India to support other women, campaigning for girls' education and the legal rights of Indian women living in Purdha. And now we have pioneering businesswomen like Clara Freeman, Isla Bush, Sibella Stanley, Shriti Vadera, and Sasha Romanovich, who in the 21st century are still working in a world which is dominated by men. We have, and we have had, scientists whose groundbreaking research changes lives, the most eminent being Dorothy Hodgkin, a chemist, still the only British woman scientist to have won the Nobel Prize. But you know, in press coverage of the prize, she was described as, not as a leading scientist, but an Oxford housewife wins Nobel Prize. That was 1964. We have come a long way. But she used her prize money in 1964 to set up the nursery and was the first fellow to have enjoyed maternity leave. Most importantly, she was tutor to perhaps our most famous alumni, Margaret Thatcher, who was elected Prime Minister on the 4th of May, 1979. Even 40 years ago, she was very much a woman in a man's world, just one of 19 women in the House of Commons at the time, in the House of Commons of 635 MPs. It's no secret that I didn't share Lady Thatcher's politics, but she was truly a remarkable woman, and I'm immensely proud that our first woman Prime Minister was a Somervillian. Indeed, she was one of the most influential Prime Ministers that this country has ever seen. Mrs. Thatcher was a polarising figure, but whether you agreed with her or not, she was a giant in politics. She had the leadership qualities that I think are sorely lacking in both government and in opposition today. While she dominated my early political life, I didn't meet her until I went to the Lords, by which time she was increasingly frail, but her appearances were always electrifying. For a brief period in 2008, I was government chief whip in the Lords. And when I saw Lady Thatcher on the benches opposite, I knew that I had problems. I had a horrible feeling in the pit of my stomach. And not because of her, but because I knew that I was going to lose. But briefly, I looked at some Hansards this morning from 2008. And I noticed that one of the appearances she made was related to an amendment on the climate change bill. The amendment was won, my government lost, and I must have had some explaining to do around the cabinet table. In recent weeks, and thanks in part to a strong young woman, Greta Thunberg, there's been a much-needed focus on climate change. And I think it's too little known that Margaret Thatcher was the first head of government to speak up publicly about climate change and the risk to the global environment. Indeed, she exerted a profound influence on the world in so many ways, including recognition of the opportunity offered by Gorbachev's accession to power in the Soviet Union, which brought the end of the Cold War. Margaret Thatcher says in her memoirs, "Before I went up to Oxford, I had a less clear idea of what the place would be like than did many of my contemporaries, but I regarded it as being simply the best, and if I was serious about getting on in life, then that is what I should always strive for." And she did. I have no doubt that she had to, or at least she felt she had to, work twice as hard as a man in order to succeed. I suspect, however, that she might have thought, like Barbara Castle, that part of her power over her male colleagues derived from the fact that she had a brain as good as theirs, plus the arts of femininity. B. Campbell suggested, "Femininity is what she wears, masculinity is what she admires." She certainly burst through the glass ceiling, and she proved it can be done, but she was not a feminist. Like many men then, and some men now, she did not see the value of appointing women. In the 11 years of her premiership, she only appointed one woman to her cabinet. And I have to say that it wasn't until recently that I considered the ways in which, despite her strength, her determination, and her domination over her male cabinet, she was subject to sexism and sexist views. Margaret Thatcher was a lawyer as well as a chemist and a politician, and she was thus a beneficiary of the Sex Disqualification Removal Act of 1919, which enabled women to enter the professions. It also permitted universities to award degrees, which Oxford chose to do the following year, following a campaign spearheaded by another Somervillian, Emily Penrose, the first woman to get a first in greats at Oxford, who was later our principal. Women had waited a long time for this emancipating act. Mary Harris Smith was an accountant who first applied to join the Society of Incorporated Accountants and Auditors in 1887, but she was rejected on account of her gender. She made several further applications, but it was not until 1920 that she was admitted, and at the age of 75, she became the first female chartered accountant. We've come a long way in the last 100 years, but I would suggest not far enough. There have still only been 45 women in the cabinet since the first woman, Margaret Bonfield, was appointed in 1929. And whilst I celebrate the fact that the percentage of women on FTSE 250 boards was 23.7 in 2018, sadly the number of all male boards rose to 10, and the number of women holding the most senior jobs in the boardroom was just 6.4%. Only 22% of our universities are led by women, but I'm proud that at Oxford we've got the superb leadership of Louise Richardson, our Vice-Chancellor. It's a mixed picture, much progress, but some industries are going backwards. The tech industry used to be dominated by women, but now they only make up about 22% of the workforce. I think Ada Lovelace, who was taught by Mary Somerville, would be turning in her grave. And in yesterday's FT, there was an article about female asset managers struggling to attract investments, even as they outperform their male peers. So why? Why is it that whilst women make up 51% of the population, we're still woefully represented at the top of most, if not all, professions? And why are there so many leaks in the pipeline? For the first time this year, more women than men were admitted to Oxford as undergraduates. Will that mean that in 20 to 30 years' time there'll be an equal number of men and women at the top of our public, private and voluntary sectors? Lady Thatcher said, "You don't suddenly appear on the bottom rung of a ladder and then at the top. You have to climb up each rung as it goes." Great, but one has to ask why the ascent of most women has been so slow. Is it because we've not been acting like the men who have climbed and are climbing the ladders more swiftly? I know that some in the Twitter sphere have said that, why are you dealing with this subject? It's so dated, get on with it. And I would suggest that, 40 years ago, women perhaps did have to act like men in order to succeed. Perhaps they don't have to act like men now, but why is it that women aren't succeeding? So many questions. And this evening we are very fortunate to have an inspirational panel who will give us their perspective before we open up the discussion and questions from the floor. And I think I'm going to sit down in the middle, and I think I'm going to start with Mary Arden, Lady Arden of Heswell, the first female High Court judge to have been assigned to the Chancery Division, then a judge on the Court of Appeal, and recently appointed to the Supreme Court, where there are now 9 men and 3 women. So, yay!
Thank you very much for that warm welcome, and I'm delighted to be here and to see so many people present for this discussion. Just to fill in a little bit about what Jan has already, the principal's already told you, I joined the bar in the early 1970s. There were certainly no women in the chambers when I got there, and I didn't expect there to be. That wasn't how it happened in those days. I was taught in my university career by Professor Glanville Williams. Little did I know that in 1971, just before I went to the bar, he'd written a book in which he said, women are not generally prepared to give battle unless annoyed, and so don't make very good barristers. But there we were, all coming out of university, expecting that the world was our oyster, and it was going to be extremely interesting and extremely easy for women. After all, we'd all got our degrees. We couldn't have been further from the truth, especially when I arrived and found there were not many women. Margaret Thatcher had actually been in Lincoln's Inn before I got there. She had actually had to leave because she had twins, and that was regarded as not compatible with the continuation of what was a very successful career as a tax barrister. Anyway, I remained at the bar for 24 years. I didn't have a woman member in my chambers for about 10 years. And as you've heard, in due course I went on to the Chancery bench, and then I became the first, and still am, the only woman to have chaired the Law Commission of England and Wales. I did that as a High Court judge, then went to the Court of Appeal, where I remained for 18 years. Now, the crucial thing is that in the Court of Appeal, we started off at under 10% women, but by the time I left, we were 25% women. And the interesting question which you might like to ask us about in due course is why and how does that sort of change happen? I witnessed it happen, and I think I have a little to say about it. But let me just say I'm delighted to be here because this is an opportunity to celebrate not just the successes but also the failures. There were many brave women who did not succeed and whose lives were made much the poorer by the fact that they didn't get a chance to do what we have done. For instance, there was you probably read the Heidi stories. Well, the niece of the Heidi author tried to be an advocate in Switzerland, and pointed to the Swiss constitution. You think the Swiss are very fair people, and it says every citizen will be treated equally. So she said, well, my husband can be a lawyer. Why can't I be a lawyer? And the court said, well, we didn't think that that was what it was intended to cover, and so she lost. And so many people have been rebuffed, and my feeling is we still have a long way to go. Only this week, there was a report published by a very senior organisation, the International Bar Association, to say that 1 in 3 women in the law could say they were sexually harassed, and 1 in 2 could say that they'd been bullied. Those are horrific. That was a global survey, but they are horrific percentages. So what is the position in the UK? Well, as I see it, there are still issues about practising as a barrister. Only about 3 weeks ago, a senior criminal barrister, a woman, Silk, actually stood down from the bar. She had just had her third child and a few months before, and she had then been asked to turn up to do a trial, which was going to start the following week, in which at least a month's preparation was required. And she said, this job is totally incompatible with my looking after my 3 children. And one must understand that. And she actually left the bar. So do women have to behave as men to succeed? Well, in my view, women should be themselves, but often they can't. Let's take shared parental leave. That means, of course, either men or women mothers or fathers can take leave to look after newborn children. But I can see how the conversation goes. No, it wouldn't be a good idea if I took off the leave and took paternal leave, because after all, I would stand in line for getting bonuses and promotions and pay rises. And it's much better that you stay at home and look after the child. So while I think shared parental leave is a good move, it's not necessarily going to produce fast results. Another result which I think is very worrying is that many women have decided not to have children, and I think that they are certainly subject to the give the impression that one of the reasons why they make that decision is that they want to have a career and fear that they can't have a career unless they make that decision. So for my money, women should be themselves, and they should, by being themselves, help, by their what they do, help other women on the way as well. One of the worries that I have about artificial intelligence and all the opportunities that that may give everybody in society is that, unfortunately, the number of women who are computer scientists is very small. And so jobs will go to the people who are qualified computer scientists, and the cuts will be made at the levels at which many women coming back after a pregnancy often find themselves. And that's a big issue, bringing women back into work after they've had children and ensuring that they make a smooth transition. And it may be some of the other speakers who have closer experience of that will be able to give you some more guidance on that. All I want to say is true equality comes when we don't have to be here to discuss this question. Thank you.
So next I'm going to ask Sasha Romanovich to speak. Sasha is a Somervillian. She studied here and she worked at Grant Thornton for 28 years and ended up as its CEO and was the first woman to lead a UK top six accountancy firm. And she left quite recently and now she's working on social mobility, which is fab.
Do you want me to stand up?
You can stand or sit or
whatever. I might stand because then it's sort of...
Stand up.
It gets my steps going.
That's good, yeah. Take your phone.
I don't normally stand behind podiums. So thank you, everybody, for coming out this evening. When I'm preparing for sessions like this, I'm often thinking about conversations that I have with my children. I have two sons and I have a husband who's stayed at home with them whilst I've been out sort of doing the career thing. And one of the conversations I had with my then, he was about five, who on Sunday evenings often we'd be talking about what I was going to be doing at work in the week because I'd be going up to London and leaving them at home. And one of these days Scott said, "So what are you doing tomorrow?" And I said, "Oh, I'm meeting with Scott." And he goes, "Scott? Who's Scott?" And it's quite interesting because the conversations with my children often actually give you a real insight into the assumptions that we have about the world and the way that we think about it. When I was thinking about this question, there were two things that come to mind for me. One is when we talk about success, what do we actually mean by success? Yeah. And the other one is actually thinking about, if you've got a definition of success, well, how is the world operating and set up? So I just wanted to unpick those two because I think they're quite important for the role that future leaders need to play in shaping the world in which we live. So first of all, if we look at the definition of success, really actually goes right back to the period that Jan was talking about in terms of the 1880s as we entered the industrial era. And success was very much then defined in a world of abundance, in the world of the Industrial Revolution, at a period in time that was actually really sort of led by prosperous white men, yeah, who defined the rules. And they defined the rules of success according to what made sense to them. Yeah. And so that has left us with a legacy of a definition of success of a binary short-term delivery of profit and accumulation of wealth. And if you think back to that time, it was before women could even own property, right? That didn't come until much later on. And so a lot of our systems have been set up around a definition of success that is very binary and short-term, focused on financial returns. and also an operating system that's built in laws and values to protect the interests, the public interest as it was defined at the time, was actually aligned with a very small group of individuals and the world that made sense to them at the time. And I think those are pretty important, because what we have as we stand here in 2019 are two things that are still true. If you look at the operation of the city and the operation of many of our laws, what do they prioritise? You know, look at the stock exchange in terms of how that operates, yeah? How it's valuing companies. It's on incredibly short-term financial measures. And so what we have actually promulgated is a system whereby people are actively incentivised to make choices that are not in the long-term interests of us thriving on this planet. And I think that definition of success is the first one that you really have to think about and challenge, because it is very easy to be seduced if you're going into the world and trying to fit in, to be seduced into fitting in with the world as it is, rather than challenging, are we actually valuing the things that are going to be important for our future? So that's the first thing I'd say, is we've really got to think about success and to be thinking about that very critically in the role we play in the world, rather than just fitting in with the system as it is. And certainly since standing down at Grant Thornton, I've turned down a number of non-executive positions where I felt there was the opportunity to challenge and change the system, but the appetite just wasn't there in the board, and they felt that they just wanted to focus on the short-term profit agenda rather than a real opportunity to drive significant systemic change. So with that definition of success comes with, what is the operating system in which the world's operating? Because I think that then defines what's the leadership then kind of fits with the operating system. And I think we're still operating with the operating system that we have inherited from the industrial age. It's an operating system that actually has three key characteristics. One is that in terms of, you know, your reason for being within the system is actually the generation of personal wealth and interest. Yeah? And that that motive is an important goal. The second is this idea that competition, that if we slug it out and fight it out, that that will actually deliver the best results. And the third is this idea of hierarchy, that a few smart people in the room can pull levers and tell people what to do and out will pop results. It's a very mechanistic view of the world. And the leaders in that mechanistic view of the world have a very, you know, it's known as the alpha stereotype, right? And I think the interesting thing is that that operating system isn't fit for purpose for the challenges we face in the world. And that leadership model is turning off just as many great women, great men as it is women. Yeah. In my career, I saw just as many men who felt they didn't fit the prevailing paradigm of what a great leader looks like as I met women. So what's the operating system instead? I think that it's really important that we actually start to operate in a way where we think about, why are we doing business? How are we serving life in what we do, rather than this bizarre idea that life is here to serve business? Yeah. And to really be able to think about that in all of our activities, of how are we actually serving life as we're on this planet? What is our common purpose? What are we actually trying to solve? And in the world we're in today, there are really big complex issues, as we all know. And it's why the operating system has to change, because we need to have those big challenges out there. And then we need to think about, well, how do you actually have an operating system that sets us up to tackle them? I think we can see in our parliament that the combative fight doesn't actually lead to progress. You need that collaboration of people actually working together, bringing their different ideas and thoughts to be able to deliver solutions. And how deeply that operating system is embedded into our system is really quite phenomenal. Think about those of you who have kids in schools. How many of them still have that, don't copy, do your own work? Yeah, that whole thing of, you know, you win, I lose. We embed in the very skills that actually aren't going to be helpful to us actually working together. I think the other thing is that in terms of the operating system, this idea of hierarchy, people telling us what to do, actually what we're seeing is the world is actually saying, no, that doesn't work for us anymore. Mm. Yeah? you know, the rise of populism, I am an optimist. I do think that there is the opportunity that out of that comes the opportunity to actually really draw on the power of the crowd, to think about the power of community, to actually think about how through devolution we pass things down to people. So I think that opportunity to think about how we define success and what is the operating system for the world then gives an opportunity for a very different type of leadership. And it's not the alpha leader, it's the catalyst.
That's good. We need catalysts.
So I think that's the opportunity for us to think about as women going into the world and men going into the world, is fitting into the paradigm of the operating system and the current prevailing model of leadership isn't going to actually give us a future we're proud to hand on to our children. And I'll just finish saying, with going back to who's Scott. My son had always seen me as the woman going to work. And when I said to him, and he said, who's Scott? And I said, Scott at the time was my boss, the CEO who put me onto the board. And so I said, well, Scott's my boss. And he goes, but Scott's a man's name. And he said, men don't go to work.
It's better, thank you. David, you're a man who went to work, who goes to work. Yes. So David was an MP. He's now chair of the Minister for Education and Science. He now chairs the Resolution Foundation, which I have to say I think is a brilliant think tank, doing wonderful work. But most importantly, from today's perspective, or meeting today, he worked closely with Mrs. Thatcher when he worked in the policy unit in Number 10. David.
Thank you very much, Jan.
The token man.
It's great to be here as the token man. It's a great honour. And I thought Jan's opening explanation of the significance of 2019, 40 years from so many really significant events, and what you're celebrating as well, is fantastic. So let me begin by very briefly answering the exam question, which is one of the things I was taught to do when I was up at Oxford. Should women behave more like men in order to succeed? I think the answer is no. Explaining why it's no is actually quite tricky, because you start getting into dangerous territory of assuming sets of stereotypes about male behaviour and female behaviour that aren't necessarily helpful. And I will come back to that one at the end. I'll briefly reflect on Mrs. T and her. But I do think that those people who tweet say, why are you stuck in this old debate? No, it's a very live debate. I mean, the Sheryl Sandberg leaning in strategy is a very hot topic. And I personally think leaning in is not the right approach. And one of the important ways in which we can strengthen business, strengthen decision-taking in politics, is by having a greater range of voices around the table, and diversity achieves that. Gender is just one aspect of it, but there is empirical evidence that more diverse boards take better decisions, they have a greater understanding of the environment within which they are operating. So I think the answer no follows as a result of a belief in diversity. You then get into very difficult questions. Are there ways, can we assume in general female behaviour is different from men? There's actually been some quite interesting empirical analysis of the behaviour of women managers, which hasn't found any significant differences in the way day-to-day they function compared with men. But there probably are some underlying differences in values. They're going to be tested looking forward. I'm fundamentally an optimist, by the way, about what's happening. But the news is mixed. I think it's going to be very interesting to see how the digital economy and the AI revolution and machine learning changes the environment. And you can see pros and cons. There was a very interesting article by Sarah O'Connor, one of our most astute economics commentators, saying that when you look at the jobs impact of robotics and AI, I'm not fundamentally a pessimist about that either. I don't think we're all going to be unemployed. The jobs that are going to be losing out are the relatively standardised data handling jobs, which I have to say are predominantly still in our economy done by men. and the increasing value will be on the service jobs, the jobs that require empathy, the jobs that require human interaction, which, if I may stick with this danger area of the stereotype, may be an area where women have a better prospect than men. So the AI digital revolution might well winnow out those type of jobs which have tended to be male. On the other hand, machine learning works on data, and data comes from the past. Data tells you how things have been done, and we all know the horrific examples of if you just use machine learning and analyse data and then use that to define the person you're going to recruit as a manager or the person you're going to recruit to your company, you often get the most appalling stereotypes, and women lose out, people from ethnic minorities move out. So there are challenges as well. I think we are making fantastic progress, and I just want to briefly talk about the jobs market, but talking to my friends in politics, female friends in politics, someone like, say, Nikki Morgan, who used to be my PPS, I do buy the argument that the treatment that women get in the social media is significantly worse than for men, and that is a new problem, a new threat that didn't arise 10 or 20 years ago. Nevertheless, the basic labour market story is good. The education labour market story, in fact, is fantastic, with now women's educational accomplishments matching and indeed on many measures exceeding men. And the evidence we've collected at Resolution Foundation is that in their 20s there is now no gender pay gap. As the female graduates enter the jobs market, they do as well as the male graduates. If anything, there's a slight premium now. If anything, in their 20s women may earn on average a tiny bit more than men. However, the big change is when the kids arrive. And the progress is that when you look at all the graphs, and I haven't brought any Resolution Foundation slides today, but when you look at the graphs, it's overwhelming. It's when the kids arrive that these trends that have previously been, up to there it's been favourable, if I say, if anything, it's like female advantage. That's when they change. So the policy focus has to be what happens when the children arrive and how the labour market and employment adjusts. And of course, one of the paradoxes, for me as a conservative, one of the paradoxes is that, well, you get used to the idea that well-intentioned initiatives often have perverse effects. It is a very interesting question whether in the long run improved provision for maternity pay and maternity rights, which is manifestly a good thing, I'm not against maternity pay and maternity rights, whether actually the things that have enabled women to do longer out of the labour market after the first kids have arrived, whether that has contributed or held back their long-term economic success. So we have to approach this on the basis of the initiatives which are clearly admirable, but realising that they can have side effects that actually compound the problem. So I have to say, not very palatable, one of my pieces of advice for young women when they do have kids is try to get back into the jobs environment rapidly. And employers need to do so much more to help people who have been out for a time. It's the little things. It's the software code. The software system has been updated and changed while you are out for a year or 2 years. And when you come back, nobody makes the effort to reintroduce you to their working practice. Some of your crucial allies, some of your friends in management, they've moved on and it's a different group of people. You have to make more of an effort to get to know them. It's all that kind of stuff. So keeping engaged with employment, if you do decide to take some time out when the kids are very young, is incredibly important. Just to end, as Jan said, how I had worked for Margaret Thatcher, and it was a fantastic privilege to do so, I guess I should reflect as to where Margaret Thatcher is, how she fits in to the feminism debate. And Jan said she wasn't a feminist. I think it's a bit more complicated than that. I would say that being a woman made Margaret Thatcher an outsider, and that was crucial to her political identity. She was not part of the club, and the fact that she took Britain in a different direction in 1979 was because many of the conventional socialising processes of the Conservative Party in the 50s, 60s and 70s, joining the dining clubs, having the drinks at the bar, a lot of that networking she just didn't do. And it was crucial for the way that she functioned that a lot of these ties that had created these networks pulling people into the conventional thinking had not worked in that way on her. So I think that being an outsider was fundamental. In the 3 years or so that I worked for her, and Jan was right, I think that then the question is, well, why were there so few women in her cabinet or in government? If you'd been a visitor from Mars, I thought, observing these meetings, it would look completely obvious to you. There is a leader who wears specially bright clothes and dresses differently and looks differently, and then there are the followers who are all condemned to wear dark suits and sit in rows. It would have been completely obvious, the leadership principle of this society. And actually, a second person also wearing bright clothes and looking different at some peculiar place two-thirds down the row of heads around the committee would have completely confused the message. There was one leader, and that's what made you distinctive. So I think partly being the outsider and then becoming the leader was a process of advance which actually made it quite hard for other women to slot in to that model. I think it made it harder. I don't think she was, from my experience, I don't think it's true that she was not, she had many characteristics. At some point, I promised Jan I was going to tell her the AIDS briefing story, but I don't think I'm going to tell you. We'll do it in questions.
No, go. Guys, we have to spend the time on this. Tell that story.
Well, no, it's only because... And I had forgotten. So I worked on DHSS. All of us in the policy had different areas we worked on, these kind of departments we advised on. So I did Treasury and what was then called the DHSS. And during my time there, one of the things that happened was the AIDS crisis blew up. So I had to organise, and I remember still the meetings when we got the chief medical officer in and briefed her on what we knew about AIDS and what the origins of AIDS were. Where, incidentally, she was not a prissy woman. You know, you did have to go through gory information about exactly what was happening, and she was not shocked. She wasn't in any way naive about things. And then Norman Fowler wanted to have an advertising campaign warning people about some of the behaviour that increased the risks of AIDS, as we understood it at the time, with medical knowledge and treatments that we had at the time. And one of the issues was that he wanted some pretty explicit advice. And I had forgotten about all this until, when, under the 30-year rule, these papers all start appearing. And it happens at the end of the year. And on about the 30th of December, you start having journalists phone you up about something you'd written 30 years ago, which you've got no recollection at all. Anyway, I wrote a note to her about exactly how explicit the information about sexual activities should be in our information campaigns. And Margaret Thatcher wrote on it in her distinctive... It always brings it back to looking at her notes, communicating that way. And Margaret Thatcher wrote on my brief two words in her handwriting that do not exist in her handwriting anywhere else and excited the journalists, because she said, "Do we need the section on risky sex?" In fact, sex had got a capital S for reasons I don't quite understand. So Margaret Thatcher writing risky sex had caused for a 24-hour stir. People had found this document 30 years later, and it so happened it had been on something I'd written. But the actual thing I was going to say about, and it's true about how we briefed her on AIDS and lots of other things, if I were going to define another crucial characteristic of Margaret Thatcher, which is something also associated with her education here at Somerville, but is not her gender, it is that she was a scientist. In fact, I would go further and say she was a particular sort of scientist. She was an empirical scientist. She wasn't a grand theoretician scientist. She was working in the lab, assembling the data on stuff, scientist. So for me, arriving in number 10, looking back, it was absurd, I was 28, arriving in the policy unit, seconded from the Treasury as a civil servant, not as a political advisor. The thing I noticed about her, briefing her on health, social security, some economic stuff, is she wanted the facts and the evidence. It was highly empirical. And she didn't want pretentious stuff from this young man about conservative political strategy. She would bombard me with questions on Social Security. So how many years of national insurance contributions do you need to have in order to get a full pension? Are there still contribution conditions to get your unemployment benefit? When was the female pension age last changed? And she would expect you to be able to answer those kind of questions. And if you couldn't answer those type of questions, she would not trust your judgment. And there were stories that had gone around Whitehall of sort of senior officials come in to brief her on closing the steel plants like Ravenscraig, which was a great controversy in the early 80s. When she had bombarded them with questions, so exactly how many thousand tons of steel are produced by Ravenscraig? How does that compare with the largest steel plants in other countries? And they couldn't always answer these questions. And she would say, you are expecting me to take a decision affecting the livelihoods of hundreds, if not thousands of people, without turning up armed with the necessary information. There was at least one minister who had this treatment, who was supposed to have burst into tears because she was asking him the basics and he couldn't answer. My view of her was that actually what I found was that she was an empiricist. She was and if you follow the evidence and you're not a member of the club, you can get an awful long way. Well, thank you very much.
Was a Somervillian. So now Anja Hindmarsh is a fantastic entrepreneur who was inspired by Mrs. Thatcher to become an entrepreneur. I read we've got things about you in our brief, Anja, but I was reading on Wikipedia, as one does. And Anja went to, I'm sure it's not all true, but I like this story, I hope it is. Anja went to Florence when she was 18 to learn Italian, and there she noticed some beautiful bags, decided that she could do this in the United Kingdom, and using Mrs. Thatcher as her inspiration, she became an entrepreneur. And look at you now, Anja.
Well, yes, thank you. Look at me now. First of all, I'm so glad we got that story out of David. That was we had in the sort of the green room, and we teased it out of him early, which is fantastic. First of all, thank you for inviting me. I wasn't up at Oxford, so I'm hoping that I can indeed ask.
Oh, we're delighted.
My name is Anja Hindmarsh. I'm neither Russian nor German. From Essex and didn't go to Oxford, so it's a really bad start, I think. But answering the question, I think the answer is, and I'm going to answer from a very personal standpoint as a business person, as a woman. No, I haven't had to behave like a man to succeed. And I think the fashion industry is quite particular, it's quite female heavy, so maybe that's an advantage. But of course, there are certain cultures where it's been a bit tricky for me, where I might be in Japan, for example, where I'm with my husband, and they will start by replying to my husband before me. But quite soon, they will realise who perhaps might make the decision and who is key, and they will, I think, then turn to me and you get involved. So those things, you kind of get through. But there are certain cultures, without a doubt, that need a sort of a bit of a push, perhaps. The only time, I think, that I felt a bit stung, actually, by sort of being a woman and felt a bit out of the loop, if you like, was someone, actually a French male, I have to say, who's probably the trickiest in some respects in my experience, who once, and so we were having a sort of financial meeting in a sort of lawyer's office, and he said, Anja, you have to take the emotion out of this. And it felt like a bit of a slap. It felt like someone saying, Anja, stop being a girl, you know, how you might have had in the past. And this was, I wish I had had the right answer at the time. In fact, what I think is the right answer is actually, if women have an edge, it's because they do put emotion into things. Mm. And I would argue, in fact, that emotion is perhaps a female superpower. But actually, in addition, on reflection, I would say that perhaps is not a female nor a male trait. It's a trait that is actually perhaps important in any leader of people. So I think that stung, but I'm now armed when I have that attack again. I went to a really interesting talk this week, actually, by an Israeli scientist who is doing some studies on the difference of how men and women behave, and she was doing her studies on worms, which was quite interesting. But nonetheless, she has managed to prove absolutely that women and men do react differently to certain situations, and in fact, women react differently. They react to danger, and men actually just plough on. And that is just a sort of genetic difference, which is quite fascinating. So I think it's fair to say we are different, and as far as I'm concerned, that's fine. I think, however, you can get a great result with different routes. And so whilst we might be slightly different, we can all succeed and have a great result in any case. I don't really notice if someone is male or female when I'm working with people. In the same way, I don't notice if someone has red hair or curly hair or blonde hair. It's actually doesn't interest to me. I notice what they bring to the table. That's the thing that actually sticks with me. I don't care either whether actually it's a him, a her, a they, or indeed a scaly. I came across my first scaly the other day in my son's art university, which is quite fascinating. All of that is absolutely fine by me, as long as it's not attention-seeking, because that becomes a bit annoying. And I think that in my experience at work, gender is sort of a sliding scale. I have some quite male-female friends, and I have some quite female-male friends and colleagues as well. I think, to the point on childcare, that it's very important that women play fair in the workplace. I think, you know, good communication and accepting that sometimes if you're, you know, taking time off for children as you need to do or for maternity, that, you know, it can be very difficult in the workplace for your colleagues around you. So good communication and just, you know, not assuming that that's your right, actually being kind and good colleague is very, very key as well. But I do think, and contradicting it to what Lady Arden said, I do think that paternity leave actually is a bit of a checkmate moment. I had my first paternity request about 3 years ago, and I remember thinking, oh, after all these women that I employed, this is a nightmare. And I suddenly realised, actually, that, of course, now when I interview people, actually, it's not a disadvantage being a woman, because, in fact, men can be just as disruptive, if you like, because it is disruptive in the workplace to have people taking time out. And sometimes they take a year and come back for a year, and then another year and come back. And it's quite hard to staff when you're employing people. So, actually, I think that will have an effect. And I think men, in addition to that, will also have a closer bond with their children and want to be more involved in the art room with their children as well. So I think that's actually quite an important moment. And I think it's incumbent on all of us to encourage men to take that time and to share that burden. I do think, however, that between the sexes, it must be fair. I think that's the one thing that is absolutely paramount. I think it was key, and I think we nearly have, but to break down that boys' club that David spoke about, that Margaret Thatcher probably encountered. I think the pay gap is inexcusable. I think that now has sort of been called, if you like, and I think that's important. And I think that role models are fundamental in breaking down the stereotype of the sort of female role in the world. And so I think it's also important for women because it means they believe they could. And I think seeing people doing it is really, really fundamental. Which brings me, of course, nicely to Lady T, my slight heroine, I have to say. We were sharing stories earlier. For me, she was absolutely a role model. I know she was Marmite in particular, but she was, for me, someone who was a woman, but still had strength and still was in command, which is exciting. Like, that excited me when I was at school. I'll never forget her speech where she said, I'm enjoying this, when she finally stood down in the Commons. And I remember thinking how incredibly strong and confident that was. That really stuck with me. And I was lucky enough to be able to tell her this, actually, which was quite special for me. And, of course, anyone who had any part in inventing Mr. Whippy is you know, obviously a friend as far as I'm concerned. So, to sum up, I think women have already come a long way in a short period of time. I think probably in certain cultures and certain industries it needs a shunt a little bit, but actually watch this space. I think it'll gain momentum, and I think that actually watch out. And my poor son, who's sort of, you know, late 20s and white and you know, struggles in some ways because actually it's tough unless you're a girl. Actually, it's tougher for those girls at that age now. I think role models are key, but I think it's happening. So, in short, I don't feel like I need to be a man, and in fact, I really like.
And now we have, before we move to questions, we have Cindy Gallup, who's another Somervillian, quite an extraordinary Somervillian, who was founder and former chair of the US branch of Bartle Bogle Hegarty, but now she's also founded some websites, Make Love Not Porn, but also If We Ran the World, and she is passionate about gender equality, diversity in general, and spends a lot of her time trying to nurture men to ensure that they better understand women, but also to inspire women. Cindy.
Thank you. So I was an undergraduate here at Somerville reading English in 1979. I was president of the Somerville Drama Society, and so I had the honour of directing the Somerville Centenary play in the Quad, William Witch's Love in a Wood, in the year of the Somerville Centenary. And it seems peculiarly appropriate that the year that marked 100 years of the college that was started to enable women to go places they'd never gone before was the same year that old Somervillian Margaret Thatcher was elected to be Prime Minister. I have three points of very subjective response to the question, should a woman behave like a man to be successful? And the first one is obviously no. Women should not behave like men to be successful, but in fact, quite the opposite, men should behave like women to be successful. I regularly hear from women who say to me, in the context of my absolutely championing, positive action and quotas, oh, but Cindy, I don't want to get hired just because I'm a woman. And my response to that is, get over it and look around you at all the mediocre men who got hired just because they were men. My friend Thomas Hamaro Premusic has just published a book that I urge all of you to order and read immediately. It is a book that came out of a very successful Harvard Business Review article he wrote a number of years ago, one of the most read Harvard Business Review pieces of all time, and it's called Why Do So Many Incompetent Men Become Leaders? And the point he makes in the book is, it is absolutely true that competent women face many barriers driven by the glass ceiling, but he says the far bigger issue is the lack of barriers for incompetent men. My background is advertising, and I will be speaking this year at the biggest global gathering for our industry, the Cannes Lions Advertising Festival, next month. And Cannes asked me to host, they do a series of meetups, and they asked me to host a meetup whose title is, or was, How to Become a Great Female Leader. And so I wrote back to them and said, I'm very happy to do this if you will change the title and the premise, which they now have. My meetup at Cannes is now called How to Benefit from Great Female Leadership, and it calls on both women and men to attend this meetup, and for men to share examples of all the times they've benefited from working for great female leaders. Because men need great female role models as much as women do. The well-known phrase, you cannot be what you cannot see, applies to men as much as it does to women. And one of the issues we have, and by the way, men, this is frequently unconscious on your part, but men subconsciously believe they have nothing to learn from women. And men have a huge amount to learn from great female leaders. The second point I would make is, and I think this has been alluded to already, but in the same way that as many men as women dread going to work on Monday morning, don't want to work the hours they have to work to stay in the rat race, want to spend more time with their children, never doubt that as many women as men yearn to build something great, to change the world, to actually have a huge amount of power on their own terms, and to make a huge amount of money. And that's my second point in response to this, because I urge women, and I won't articulate it the way I normally do, but I urge women to make a humongously colossal amount of money and to be completely unashamed about wanting to do so. Because money is power, and money changes everything. When we make a huge amount of money, we can then fund other women. We can support other women. We can donate to other women. We can help other women. And we need to do this because we need to build our own financial ecosystem because the male one is not working for us. And so when we make that money, we can change so many things, including redesigning the world of business. Because the entire nature of the corporate hierarchical structure as it exists today is predicated on the concept of the housewife. The entire corporate structure and system was designed and built up over centuries on the premise there would only ever be men who went to work and there would always be a woman at home taking care of everything else. Today, everything's changed, but that structure still hasn't. And so we live in a world where the default setting is always male. Men, you have no idea how much happier you would be living in a world that was 50-50 equally led, influenced, and designed by all of us, including the ability to redesign the future of business around parenting. And note, I don't say motherhood, I say parenting. Because everything you've heard about the need for childcare and flexible working hours, etc., applies to men parenting as much as women. And we change all of that for everybody when we redesign the way the corporate system works around the concept of parenting in totality. And we will have so many more happy men as much as happy women. And by the way, I would just say on that point too, because in many things we talk about, men, honestly, you have no idea what it's like to be a woman experiencing them. I have never wanted married. I've never wanted children. I'm not a mother. I'm enormously grateful I always knew that, as opposed to finding out the hard way by having them. But what I do know, what I do know from talking to my friends who are mothers is, oh my God, the things that happen to your body through pregnancy and childbirth. And seriously, talking about going back to work as soon as possible after giving birth is like talking about going back to birth as soon as possible, going back to work as soon as possible after having been hit by a truck. And seriously, the emails that my friends and mothers share, I mean, I won't even get graphic, but oh my God, the things that happen. Seriously, men, you have no idea. And so when I say redesign around parenting, enormously important to redesign around the fact that the female body after childbirth was not designed to go back to work as quickly as possible. And the final point I want to make is, we're talking about how women become leaders. There is one fundamental barrier beyond all others that is the reason why women do not progress up the ranks and they do not become leaders, and why we see so few leaders at the top of every single industry and every single government. And, you know, I've had reason to change my own thinking on this in the last few years. I used to talk about the fact that the single biggest business issue facing every industry and the single biggest issue facing the world at large was diversity and inclusion, lack of it. I no longer think that's the case. The single biggest barrier to women getting to leadership, the single biggest business issue facing every single industry, is sexual harassment. Because sexual harassment keeps out of power leadership and influence the female leaders who would make equality, diversity, and inclusion happen. Sexual harassment destroys women's careers. It crushes women's ambitions. It derails women's dreams. It doesn't matter how brilliant a female scientist you are at Oxford or anywhere else. It doesn't matter if you go into the world of AI determined to change everything. When you are sexually harassed and when you are bullied and encounter sexist behavior that manages you out of that sector, you will never make the difference we want you to make. And there's a very simple way to stop sexual harassment, which is to do what we have all been talking about, to make every single working environment, wherever it is, gender equal as quickly as possible. Because when you have gender equal working environments or environments that are more female than male, sexual harassment magically disappears. It no longer exists in an environment where there is no longer the implicit bro endorsement of a male-dominated environment. It's okay for men to behave like that. And it no longer happens in an environment where men and women interact every day as professional equals, where men are exposed all around them to female talent, creativity, insight, brilliance, so they cease to see women in one of only two roles, girlfriend or secretary. And so we can talk about leadership all we like, but men, until you help us change that, we will never get into leadership in the numbers that we need to design a different world for all of us. And trust me, we all want to live in that world where brilliant women lead as much as brilliant men do. Thank you very much.
I think that's absolutely right. We all want to live in that world where brilliant women lead as much as brilliant men. We do. We need that in our society. Goodness knows we do in Great Britain today. But so now we move on to questions. And because this is being recorded for a podcast, everybody who asks a question will be asked to sign an agreement, a sort of disclosure form, a release form, that's what it's called. So if you ask a question, we will ask you afterwards to sign one of these forms. I hope that will be okay.
Don't let that put you off.
No. It's your 15 minutes of fame, right?
Yeah, it's not us, it's Apple that's demanding this, of course, all those chaps in Apple. Right, so we have got one. I'm going to kick off with a question which came in advance, and I'm with every question that comes, I'm just going to ask for the views of one person or ask one person on the panel to signal whether or not they would like to answer. So this question was, often women who are straight, forthright and direct are called bossy and intimidating, while men display the same traits and are deemed confident and assertive. So what can we do to change this perception of women? Essentially, that is the question. Who would like to answer that? Not David, he's got his hand in his
No,
okay.
You're the best person to ask.
No.
Actually, I'll take that.
Go on then, go.
What I would say to that is, every one of us as female knows this fundamental dilemma. Years ago, a study was done on women in the workplace which demonstrated, unsurprisingly, that if we act in a way that comes naturally to us, we are seen as weak, feminine, ineffectual, whereas if we act like the men, we are seen as bossy, domineering bitches. And the study itself was called Damned If You Do, Doomed If You Don't. And so the answer, quite frankly, is the one I think this panel has been saying all along, which is ignore all of that and just be yourself. Act in the way that your instincts tell you to. And quite frankly, if that is responded to badly in whatever environment you're in, you want to get the hell out. You want to leave that job, leave that company, you know, change divisions, whatever it is, because anywhere that stops you acting the way you normally would is not somewhere you want to be. And I do also just want to go back to the point I made earlier about the opposite of received wisdom, which is, as women, we're regularly told things like, you know, change your vocabulary, stop saying sorry so often, don't use the word just ahead of a sentence. And so women are actually making efforts to remove those words from their vocabulary. Men, please add those words to your vocabulary. We would all be a whole better off in every work environment if men began saying sorry a whole lot more and, oh, I was just thinking, blah, 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 blah. So, be yourselves, and hopefully that will encourage more men around you to emulate your traits instead of imposing their own.
Thank you. So I'm just going to ask Sasha to add something.
One of the other things I think it ties into this is it comes into sort of people's mind of what is a great leader, what does a great leader look like? And I remember doing some work with an all-male leadership team, and I was asking them to describe their perfect teams. And we went through rugby pitches, we went through football pitches, we went through cricket matches. By the time we got to someone describing their perfect team as a group of men in a tank, I just said, right, let's just actually sort of stop and just listen to the language they're using and the type of leadership you're describing, and how helpful is that to the situation that we're in. And so I actually got them to go away and say, right, I now want you to go away and actually define a leadership situation that doesn't actually rely on war, fighting, anger, aggression. And eventually they came up with the orchestra and the conductor of the orchestra. And I think that's a really important thing, is that actually, rather than just getting a bit fed up with those things, is actually to call it out and invite people to think about what is a better model, a better metaphor for the leadership that we want to have, that actually allows people to say, well, actually, in that environment, I'd be appreciating diversity. Kindness would be important. Generosity would be important. And I think it's actually allowing all of us to draw on both our male and female qualities and to value both equally, because that's what's needed to actually lead us into the future.
I quite like that, and I think now of Mrs. Thatcher as a conductor of the orchestra around the cabinet table. Right, can I have a question from the floor, please? Yes, a lady there with an orange top on. Could you say who you are, please?
Ruth Finnegan Somervillian.
Oh, yes, hello, Ruth Finnegan
Somervillian. Classics in anthropology. That was just brilliant. I really enjoyed it, needless to say. But I'm also wondering, and I think the panel might think this was all right. It was a great question, but maybe we could also change it to say maybe it's not women's behaviour that needs to be changed, but people's, men's and women's,
yes,
attitude to women's behaviour. Especially with the final harangue from Cindy ringing in my ears, I'm sure you might agree. May I just give 2 points as to why I think this?
Yes.
Loss of that.
Two quick points.
I've been at the Open University since 1969. At the beginning, the general feeling among social scientists was, we don't want women. Mm. They will just play around. They're not real people. We want men off the factory floor. But 20, 30 years later, I don't count very well, it was, we must have more women. Women are what we need. Women are the future.
Absolutely.
Women bring up the children. Women. The other thing I've noticed was, at the beginning, I was there with 3 children under 5. It was hard work. I loved it. To be at the Open University, pioneering. But, of course, if a meeting went on until 6.30,
yeah,
I would have died rather than saying, must get home, so on. Certainly not to go and collect from nursery school.
Thank you.
But now, no, just one, the Sorry. Final point is the change. Now, men say that, and people approve. Yeah. They think it is wonderful. And I think it's not that... I think that men need to be more like the perception of women, the intuitive, sympathetic, and that will help to make the world of human beings, not just
That's
business,
a very important point. Thank you very much. I think that doesn't require an answer, really. I mean, I think you've answered your own question. Sorry, Clara. Sorry, that Clara sitting just down here. Clara Freeman is a fantastic businesswoman.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, panel. Just taking up that last point, many speakers made reference to changing corporate structures, changing the operating system that is a historic phenomenon. I wonder what we think is the most important thing going forward. More legislation, more cultural change. How are we going to drive what has been fantastic progress forward a bit faster? I'll give you one thought of my own, which is equality of opportunity in the home. We must bring up our boys to expect the same responsibilities and duties and emotional commitment to their families as we bring up our girls.
That's a great point. Yes, Anya.
Hi, Clara. I couldn't agree more. I mean, just the one thing that I think to David's point, really, about, you know, everything seems to be equal until children arrive. I think if we could crack childcare in the workplace, we would actually sort everything out. And actually, it's very difficult because all the people I work with, unless you have a sort of dedicated nanny, then you've got holidays to cover. You've got, you know, if your child's ill in a nursery, you're stuck. And you know, yet if you're a pilot at British Airways, you'd have to carry on flying the aeroplane. So if there were a way where, without much cost, there could be a really seamless and caring, great childcare option, and it must be, it can't be beyond us that we come up with that, even if it was parents getting together, so that actually there was a sort of a fallback situation if someone was ill and there was another contingency and so on, there must be a solution to this, and I think if we could solve that, we would actually make it so much easier for women to stay and work. That's the critical thing, I think.
It's absolutely true. Yes. I'm coming to you, Frank. There's somebody at the back there. Yes?
Thank you. Helen Griffiths, Somervillian.
Oh, good.
I was interested by the ideas of having catalysts to change things, and also the comment about everything being built on housewives was extremely resonant. I think what I'd like people to consider is how change, how catalysts for change can actually work in the real world, when in the real world a lot of the cards still are in the hands of very male-dominated organisations. I was formerly a partner in a city firm of lawyers, which was a bit that way inclined. just to come back to the housewife point, it was notable that all the younger partners, you know, people being made partners last year, this year, young men, not a single one, for as long as I can remember, has had a wife who actually, after children, still had a job. You know, they all built their lives on this paradigm. Now, I don't think it's just in the law, but that one of the main obstacles to women's progression is a very rigid career structure. Now, for as long as I can remember, there has been a period during which one basically has to kill oneself with work if one hopes to make any progress and not have any distractions outside. Between the ages broadly of about 29 and 34, which coincides nicely with what might be described as the window of simultaneous solvency and fertility. Now, you need solvency as well as fertility, because if without being able to pay for the childcare, you know, there's no hope of being able to continue one's career. Now, there just seemed to me to be a massive lack of male will to solve this problem. There were, by the time I left, I suppose about 20% women partners, of whom a disproportionate number had no children from choice or otherwise. And there was a culture of sort of sitting on any discussion. Yeah. So broadly, how do we sort this?
Okay, so I'm going to ask David, how do we sort it from a sort of legislative perspective? And then perhaps I'm going to ask for the legal perspective from Mary Arden. David?
Yeah, I would say that the crucial point, I absolutely agree with that, and all our evidence and resolution focuses on that, that's the inflection point, that's with a fork in the road. And it is returners. I'll be careful, I won't, let's be gender neutral about it. It's returners. There will be people who, for whatever reason, do wish to spend more time with their kids when they are very young, whether they, you know, for whatever reason. And the sense that the caravan has meanwhile moved on and it's heading off in a different direction and your contact with it is already reducing is crippling. And it's probably one of the worst wastes we have now in our jobs market is that. And you can have everything from scholarship programs to work familiarization schemes to requirements on companies to keep in touch with people who are taking paternity or maternity leave. If I may, just two statistics, which I personally think that they point in opposite directions. One is the effect of high pay on having children. So the evidence behind your observation is the more a man earns, the more children he has. The more a woman earns, the fewer children she has. So for men, children are something you can afford to pay for out of your high earnings. And for women, children are an opportunity cost. And that statistic for me captures the nature of this dilemma. The other thing, to end on a more optimistic note, so because people think, where I do disagree, I think we mustn't say things are not changing. And if you want to look at the fundamentals of this, even more fundamental than money, is time. And Jonathan Gershuni at Oxford has fascinating evidence from time use diaries over decades. And what is extraordinary is that both men and women are devoting more time to their children than they used to do. And indeed, a working parent now records in their time use diaries more time with a child under five than a non-working parent recorded 40 years ago. So there is, and it's everything else that's being sacrificed. There's less time cooking, there's less time on housework, there is less time on leisure, but time for children is increasing, and although men are still behind women, if anything, the increase in male time with kids is slightly faster than the increase in female time with kids.
That's fantastic. Mary, did you want to? You don't have to, but would
yes,
you
like no, to? Yes, no, I would like to answer that. I agree with much that David has said, And in particular, that when a woman is away from work bringing up her children, she has to be given the means to engage with the work that she would like to go back to. That's difficult to do, obviously, because you may be wanting to change job, but certainly to keep engaged with the world of work in some way. Now, their employers have an obligation, it seems to me, and many respect that obligation because they have made a considerable investment in this young woman whom they've trained, who knows their clients, who knows their business, and it's in their interest to do it. It's also often the case that consumers of products or investors in business will make the point, we're not interested in your business unless it's going to be seen to be fair. For many, many years, that was something which had no bearing in the public service from where I come, because we don't have consumers and we don't have investors. And for a long time, the penny simply didn't drop, for a very long time. Until I think, and we had a Lord Chief Justice who said, when we choose judges, we do it absolutely blind. We don't take account of any of their personal characteristics. So, of course, the fact that you'd been a woman and therefore had lower earnings at the bar, a lower kind of practice, and could afford a fewer hours in your professional career, and taking time out, pulled you back. But eventually, the penny dropped, and it dropped quite hard, which was, okay, judges, you're supposed to be fair, you're supposed to be stand up for freedom and equality. How is it that you appoint people who look just like yourself? And then the penny started to drop. And what I'm trying to say is what matters is culture change. It matters that people are talking at events like this and that the message gets home, that you ask us questions like this. The only slight quibble I have with David, and it's actually quite an important point, is please don't go back to work too quickly after having children, because you can make the wrong judgments when you're thinking your mind is half on your what you've got to do to get home and survive for the next day and half on your job. Only go back when you're ready. And I agree with Anya, much best that parents try to get together to see how they can help with the administration of children, like getting them all to school or helping out in some way at the weekends, getting them all to the rugger match or whatever.
Or the netball match.
Okay. I was just going to... So I think this again comes into some of the stuff about thinking about the system. So for me, if you think about... You know, what I think is a really dangerous thing is actually this whole paradigm of people having to work, certain numbers of people having to work zillions of hours, be absent from their communities, absent from their families, and looking at what is it we can do to enable women to operate just like that. I think that is completely the wrong model. And I think it actually comes back to this thing around what do we value? Because actually what we should be valuing in society is our progress against the UN Sustainable Development Goals. Because fundamentally, that will depend on whether we've got a world to pass on to our children that we're proud of or not. At the moment, because the only thing that we really value is economic success, that is actually causing an awful lot of decisions that are a massive detriment to our society. And I don't think that actually having a situation where an elite of women are able to pursue economic success just like the men have is actually the answer to it. In the work I'm doing on financial inclusion, just to put this into perspective, yeah, there are 11.5 million people in the UK who have less than £50 in savings. There are another 12 million of people who have less than £580 in savings. A disproportionate number of them are women with children under 35. Now, actually, what we need is for everybody to have an opportunity to have a rounded life, so work is part of it, but that they're able to contribute to communities to be able to look at what is the society that we're creating. So that's the thing that I think we just need to be really careful about. And it's when I was talking about system, that just trying to perpetuate and copy and fit into this square plug is not going to create a society that I'm proud to be part of.
Cindy. Following on from that, one recommendation for you all. A brilliant book has just been published in all of this. Do order it. It's by Darcy Lockman. It's called All the Rage, Mothers, Fathers, and the Myth of Equal Partnership. And in it, she makes the observation, women don't give up work because their husbands are rich. Their husbands are rich because they give up work.
Oh, that's a very nice obligation. Very nice quotation. Right,
I know that, including Frank, I did promise you a question, Frank, but it's 7 o'clock, so can you just ask...
No, let's have more time,
Okay. If you want... Frank, come on, just one more question, Frank.
There's a lady over there as well.
And a lady over there. Okay, Cindy, everybody's gasping. Frank, quick question, quick answers.
A modest proposal.
Modest.
If women wish to marry and have career ambitions, they should marry younger men. What happens historically is women marry men older than themselves. And all the decisions in a family life are made by the established partner. And if a man is making more than a woman, important decisions will be made on his terms.
That's
interesting. I can just say that it hasn't inhibited my wife.
Okay, so that was a suggestion that... Sorry, I know you couldn't hear it properly. That was a suggestion that if women want to succeed, they should marry men younger than themselves.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I endorse this message.
So that's, of course you do, Cindy. Yes, the lady there.
Yep.
Sorry, I don't think I can let him on that point. No, it's okay, I don't know.
You need a mic.
Dina
Medland. It was actually to Lord Willetts, but to all of you. You seem to be talking in a way that, again, assumes what Sasha's been saying, a linear progression rather than a circular one. What about older people? Ageism is one of the biggest... things in this country that we don't talk about. I believe there's research just out yesterday. Well, there was an embargoed story and I didn't have time to do anything with it. But it's very interesting. We have a real problem about recognising people who have been out of the workforce but doing other valuable, intelligent things. So how does that fit in, Lord Willetts, with what you were saying about the caravan has gone?
Yeah, I think it is. That is indeed the issue. There are... When we look at, again, there's good news and bad news. The good news is record rates of employment. The bad news is there are still people who have lost contact with the jobs market. And one of the areas of, certainly of wasted experience and talent is people in their 50s and 60s. But I have to say, if there's one, I think, you know, if we could easily list all the other inequities and wastes and frustrated abilities in our system. And I think that the angle that stares out at you increasingly with some of the statistics, which is debated less and less, is class. And I do think that the people who have... If I looked at the biggest divide in British society today, I'd have to say one route is the people who've had the opportunity of going to university, who are still, by and large, contrary to what the edgy sceptics say, on their way to pretty well-paid and often pretty satisfied lives. I think the options available for people who have not gone into higher education, male or female, are reducing.
Absolutely.
And in my list of social challenges facing Britain, I'd actually be so bold as to put it higher than ageism and even higher than gender. I think that is where there are a lot of frustrated, wasted people, and men as well as women.
I don't want to be contentious. I've heard that with great interest. But if there's going to be a need to find carers in the future with this ageing population, then surely that is a place to redirect the energies. Those people are going to be moved out of the workplace because the jobs are no longer there for them and they're not university trained, and not the women.
Oh, I love a bit of contention. So I think we're going to end on that little bit of contention. I think it's been a fascinating discussion. I wish it could go on longer. I mean, there have been some extraordinary facts, great challenges and great questions. What is success? We need role models. We need to change the system. We need to redesign our corporate system. We need to be catalysts for change. I think it's... I mean, childcare is clearly absolutely crucial to everything that we know. We know that if we can get childcare right, we know that we can improve women's opportunities and bring about more equality. I've been active in politics since 1977, and I think that at least once a month since 1977, I have been at a meeting where people have stood up and said, what we need to do is to solve the childcare question. Yes. My God, it can't be that difficult, and it's something I think that all of us... The people, everybody here in whatever profession, the academics, the lawyers, the businesswomen, the entrepreneurs, everybody, we all need to work together to try and solve that question, because that will bring about a fundamental change in our society, and it will make our society a more equal society. So I think that's one thing we've absolutely got to do. On our website, it says, if you want to change the world, come to Somerville. Now, we know that we have brought about great changes in this world.
I wrote that, by the way.
That, but very good. We know that Somervillians have brought great changes in the world since 1879, and we know that Margaret Thatcher brought about great changes in this world. There are still many more changes to be made. Many changes were suggested on this platform this evening. Changing the system, my goodness, that's quite a challenge, isn't it? But for all you young people here, all you young Somervillians, I now expect you to go forth into the world, change it so that in future we have a society in which men and women can be leaders, which men and women take responsibilities together for their care of the children, so that women, that one of our Somervillians, the fact that between the ages of 29 and 39, which are so important in terms of careers, that doesn't just hit women. So let's go forth, change the world together, and thank you so much for being here. Now we will go forth and drink wine together. Thank you.